What are you going to talk about this morning, Peter? David and Goliath. All right. And I told him he has 50 minutes. We end about 57 minutes from now at 10:40. It's all yours, Peter.
Well, good morning, everyone. It's really great to be here, and you are going to do the work. Now, you probably know the story of David and Goliath, so there isn't as much suspense in it as maybe even something like the Titanic. I mean, you know the Titanic goes down, and you know that David kills Goliath, so, you know, what else is there to study? Well, it's a familiar passage, but I want to take a familiar passage, and hopefully we're going to dig down in it and see things we haven't seen there before. It is 58 verses, and my voice is not feeling strong. So I wonder if there are some volunteers here who'd love to take a little bit of that and read it for us. You come out here, we'll get a microphone, and we're going to spend the first 10 minutes of our time together reading God's Word, because that means that even if everything we do after that is a waste of time, God's word has spoken to us. So it just cannot get any worse than having been really good, if you see what I mean. So that's great. So have we got any... don't be shy. I know Americans can be shy. We got one or two people who would minister to us in reading. You don't have to do the whole passage, just a little bit. Have you got a Bible with you? Okay, you can listen to my cracked voice then. What we're going to have, hopefully up on the screen behind us, is 1 Samuel 17. Is that able to come up? That's good. They didn't get much notice. Now, if you start feeling compassionate for me after about 10 verses and you want to come and help me out, feel free. By the way, I say the word Philistine as Philistine, which is the way it works in my dialect. Now, the Philistines gathered their armies for battle, and they were gathered at Socoh, which belongs to Judah, and encamped between Socoh and Azekah in Ephes Damim. And Saul and the men of Israel were gathered, and encamped in the valley of Elah, and drew up in line of battle against the Philistines. And the Philistines stood on the mountain on the one side, and Israel stood on the mountain on the other side, with a valley between them. And there came from out of the camp of the Philistines a champion named Goliath of Gath, whose height was 6 cubits and a span. He had a helmet of bronze on his head. He was armed with a coat of mail. The weight of the coat was 5,000 shekels of bronze. He had bronze armor on his legs and a javelin of bronze slung between his shoulders. The shaft of his spear was like a weaver's beam, and his spear's head weighed 600 shekels of iron, and his shield bearer went before him. He stood and shouted to the ranks of Israel, "Why have you come out to draw up for battle? Am I not a Philistine, and are you not servants of Saul? Choose a man for yourselves, and let him come down to me. If he's able to fight with me and kill me, then we will be your servants. But if I prevail against him and kill him, then you shall be our servants and serve us." And the Philistine said, "I defy the ranks of Israel this day. Give me a man that we may fight together." When Saul and all Israel heard these words of the Philistine, they were dismayed and greatly afraid. Anyone ready yet? You don't have to read the same speed as me. Okay, I'll press on. Have one. Okay, thank you. Madam, sir, whoever it is. Wonderful. God bless you. What's your name? Loretta. Thank you, Loretta. You just go and then someone else is going to line up and take Loretta's place, okay? So after a few, when Loretta feels tired. Thank you. So verse 12.
Now David was the son of an Ephrathite of Bethlehem in Judah, named Jesse, who had 8 sons. In the days of Saul, the man was already old and advanced in years. The 3 oldest sons of Jesse had followed Saul to the battle, and the names of his 3 sons who went to the battle were Eliab the firstborn, and next to him Abinadab, and the 3rd, Shammah. David was the youngest. The 3 eldest followed Saul. But David went back and forth from Saul to feed his father's sheep at Bethlehem. For 40 days the Philistine came forward and took his stand morning and evening. And Jesse said to David his son, "Take for your brothers an ephah of this parched grain and these 10 loaves, and carry them quickly to the camp to your brothers. Also take these 10 cheeses to the commander of their 1,000. See if your brothers are well and bring some token from them." Now Saul and they and all the men of Israel were in the valley of Elah, fighting with the Philistines. And David rose early in the morning and left the sheep with a keeper and took the provisions and went as Jesse had commanded him. And he came to the encampment as the host was going out to the battle line, shouting the war cry. And Israel and the Philistines drew up for battle, army against army. And David left the things in charge of the keeper of the baggage and ran to the ranks and went and greeted his brothers. As he talked with them, behold, the champion, the Philistine of Gath, Goliath by name, came up out of the ranks of the Philistines and spoke the same words as before. And David heard him.
We got another volunteer? Yeah, we have. Thank you, sir. Thank you, Loretta. What's your name, sir? Al. Great. Fantastic.
All the men of Israel, when they saw the man, fled from him and were much afraid. And the men of Israel said, "Have you seen this man who has come up? Surely he has come up to defy Israel. And the kings will enrich the man who kills him with great riches, and will give him his daughter and make his father's house free in Israel." And David said to the men who stood by him, "What shall be done for the man who kills this Philistine and takes away the reproach from Israel? And who is the uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God?" And the people answered him in the same way, "So shall it be done to the man who kills him." Now Eliab, his eldest brother, heard when he spoke to the men. And Eliab's anger was kindled against David, and he said, "Why have you come down? And with whom have you left those few sheep in the wilderness? I know your presumption and the evil of your heart, for you have come down to see the battle." And David said, "What have I done now? Was it not but a word?" And he turned away from him toward another and spoke in the same way. And the people answered him against as before. When the words that David spoke were heard, they repeated them before Saul, and he sent them. And David said to Saul, "Let no man's heart fail because of him. Your servants will go and fight with this Philistine." And Saul said to David, "You are not able to go against the Philistine to fight with him, for you are but a youth." And he had put a man of war from his youth. But David said to Saul, "Your servant used to keep sheep for his father. And when he came, and there came a lion or a bear and took a lamb from the flock, I went after him and struck him and delivered it out of his mouth. And if he arose against me, I caught him by his beard and struck him and killed him. His servant has struck down both lions and bears, and this uncircumcised Philistine shall be like one of them, for he has defied the armies of the living God." And David said, "The Lord who delivered me from the paw of the lion and from the paw of the bear will deliver me from the hand of this Philistine." And Saul said to David, "Go, and the Lord will be with you."
Then Saul clothed David with his armor. He put a helmet of bronze on his head and clothed him with a coat of mail. And David strapped his sword over his armor, and he tried in vain to go, but he had not tested them. Then David said to Saul, "I cannot go with these, for I have not tested them." So David put them off. And then he took his staff in his hand and chose 5 smooth stones from the brook and put them in his shepherd's pouch. His sling was in his hand, and he approached the Philistine. And the Philistine moved forward and came near to David with his shield bearer in front of him. And then the Philistine looked and saw David. He disdained him, for he was but a youth, ruddy and handsome in appearance. And then the Philistine said to David, "Am I a dog that you come to me with sticks?" And the Philistine cursed David with his gods. The Philistine said to David, "Come to me, and I will give your flesh to the birds of the air and to the beasts of the field." Then David said to the Philistine, "You come to me with a sword and with a spear and with a javelin, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. This day the Lord will deliver you into my hand, and I will strike you down and cut off your head. And I will give the dead bodies of the host of the Philistines this day to the birds of the air and to the wild beasts of the earth, that all the army may know that you were there is a God in Israel, and that all this assembly may know that the Lord saves, not with sword and spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you into your hand." Then the Philistines arose and came and drew near to meet David. David ran quickly towards the battle line to meet the Philistine. And David put his hand in the bag and took out a stone and slung it and struck the Philistine in his forehead. The stone sank into his forehead and he fell on his face to the ground. So David prevailed over the Philistine with a sling and a stone and he struck the Philistine and killed him. There was no sword in the hand of David. And then David ran and stood over the Philistine, took his sword, drew it out of his sheath, and killed him and cut off his head with it. And then the Philistines saw that their champion was dead. They fled. Then the men of Israel and Judah rose with a shout and pursued the Philistines as far as Gath and the gates of Ekron, so that the wounded Philistines fell on the way from Shearim as far as Gath and Ekron. And the people of Israel came back from chasing the Philistines, and they plundered their camp. And David took the head of the Philistine and brought it back to Jerusalem, so he put his armor in his tent. And as soon as Saul saw David go out against the Philistine, he said to Abner, the commander of the army, "Abner, whose son is this youth?" And Abner said, "As your soul lives, O king, I do not know." And the king said, "Inquire whose son this boy is." And as soon as David returned from the striking down of the Philistine, Abner took him and brought him before Saul with the head of the Philistine in his hand. And Saul said to him, "Whose son are you, young man?" And David answered, "I am the son of your servant Jesse, the Bethlehemite."
Thank you so much. Well, let's just pray and ask for God to bless our time together. We thank you so much for your word, and we just pray that right now you would speak to each one of us through what you have here. What you've said to us, Lord, drive it home to our hearts in Christ's name. Amen. One of the things with a passage like this is we feel incredibly familiar with it, and that means that often we miss out some of the details. And you can see all sorts of children's story Bibles will tell you the story of David and Goliath, but they won't tell you about the cheese. I mean, did anyone notice the cheese? It's an important part of the story, actually, the cheese. And we're going to look at why the cheese is in the story in a short while. So one of the things we see is that the Philistines and the Israelites are fighting, and they are in this valley of Elah. There are two, they're each occupying the high ground with the valley in between, and they come down and fight in the valley day after day. And it does seem that they are fighting, but every time that Goliath comes along, of course, the Israelites are very afraid. And what we can see is that Goliath, who is just named once because the rest of the passage he's just going to be called the Philistine, is incredibly intimidating. I mean, he's 9'6" or so, which is quite a lot really in terms of height. And then he's got this amazing armor. We could look at his armor as both offensive armor and defensive armor. So he has a spear, and it has an iron head weighing about 6 kilograms. And this is the sort of thing that he can throw at you. And imagine that whatever armor you have on, that iron is going to pierce through it. I mean, of course, you'll be knocked to the ground by the weight of it. Anyway, he's actually got a sword. He's got a spare weapon on his back for good measure. The shaft of his spear is described as like a weaver's beam, which is probably a reference to what you sometimes see on Greek pots, where you can see someone with a javelin and they've got some string at or cord there, which is something that they can wrap their finger around in order to get a better shot when they shoot it. In other words, he can get you at long distance. He's very large. He's very militarily trained. He also has defensive armor. He has what is on his body. It weighs about 55 kilos. Anyone confess to weighing about that much? Typical weight of many humans, that's the body weight that he actually has on him in terms of flexible armor. He's got greaves covering his legs. He's got a helmet. He's got a comprehensive strategy. Not only that, but he also has an armor bearer, particularly, we might call him a shield bearer, which I think is the phrase that's used for him. And the interesting thing is this: it's not someone who stands behind him and and Goliath says, "Oh, please, can you hand me such and such a weapon?" and so on. It's actually someone who stands in front of him. Now, when you read the Bible, you'll notice that Solomon had two different sorts of shield. There's the large shield and there's the smaller shield. And we know that one's smaller and one's larger because of the number of shekels that they had of weight inside them. This is the large sort of shield. So what you've got to imagine is someone who's got lots of military training is able to hit you at a distance and has someone standing in front of him to make sure you don't hit him. In other words, he looks completely and utterly invincible. And that's how the passage begins with a description. And what does it say? What's the reaction in verse 11? The reaction is that everyone is very afraid. We then have a change of scene. The change of scene takes us back to Bethlehem, where there's a man called David. Now, if you've been reading through 1 Samuel so far, what do you know about David? We're going to have some roving microphones, and so we're going to get some input here. Is anyone helping roving microphones, serving, you know, lollipops? Thank you so much, sir. So what do we know so far about David, if you've been reading through 1 Samuel? Anyone, don't be shy. There's going to be a lot of chance for you to...
The youngest son of Jesse.
The youngest son of Jesse. Thank you. Anything else? He's a shepherd. Great. Yes. He'd already been anointed by God. Yes. These are all great points. And what had happened straight after he'd been anointed? Something had happened that had changed his employment slightly. Anyone know what that is? Who was the youngest son, yeah. What had happened to his employment straight after he had been anointed by God?
He was called by Saul
to
play the harp.
So what had happened is he'd been a shepherd, and then he'd got a part-time job playing the harp in the palace. Just by sheer coincidence, after he was anointed as the next king, suddenly he gets palatial connections. No, it's not coincidence, of course. And he goes back and forth, and at this particular moment, he is with the sheep. And the three eldest brothers are there fighting the Philistines. Now, at this point, Jesse decides he's going to send David to take some things to the brothers. And my question for you is, did Jesse have anyone else he could have sent? Well, how do we know? Do we know that he had anyone else he could send? He had 8 sons, but the other 4 were off doing something else. So, do we know he had anyone else from this passage? You read it. So, don't you remember? Did he have anyone else to send? You did read it, yeah? We're going to have to look at little details on this passage, okay? If you've got a Bible in front of you, you can start scouring it. Please have the passage up behind us in as big a font as you can, if you don't mind those friends at the back. Well, okay, you will find later on in the passage as we read through the particular person he could have sent. But he happens to send David. Is that a coincidence? No, God seems to be planning this. And David goes, and David has 3 sorts of food he's going to take. What are the 3 sorts of food he's going to take? Cheese. Yeah, I'd mentioned that earlier. That's easy. Okay, what else? What sort of grain? Roasted grain. Yummy. Okay, and what else? Bread. Okay, who's going to get what food? The brothers are going to get all 3? No. Okay, who's going to get the food? Sorry? The commander gets the cheese. That's right. What do the brothers get? The bread and the roasted grain. Now, okay, if you're a brother, would you have liked some cheese? I guess so. You would. So why does Jesse send the cheese, the 10 cheeses, to the commander and the roasted grain to the brothers? Right, that's right. So he gives it to the guy in charge because, well, he'll look after the brothers. In other words, what's he doing? He's bribing. He's showing favoritism, isn't he? That he looks at someone and he sees how important they are, and you tailor the gift to how important they are. So the brothers get the roasted grain, and the commander of the army gets to 10 cheeses. Probably sheep's cheese, I guess, but who knows? It could have been goat's cheese as well. But anyway, that's what happens. So David then gets to see the brothers, and he gets there just as they happen to be going out to fight the Philistines. And they're calling up the war cry. And what's he do? What does he do with the gifts he's just brought in? He leaves them with the baggage man. Where do we read that? 22. Now, this is very important. He left them with the keeper of the baggage. That's going to be really important because David doesn't leave valuable stuff just lying around. Okay, he makes sure everything's looked after. We'll see that again. And then he went to the ranks of the Philistines. And at this point, out comes Goliath. What is the response of the Israelites when they see Goliath in verse 25? They ran, but what's their response, their verbal response? Anyone? Have you seen this man? In other words, they are impressed by his external appearance. They are impressed by him on the outside. Have you seen this man? Okay, what is David's response? What does he think of the Philistine? Okay, so what's his impression of the Philistine? Can we see where it is?
Well, essentially he's saying that the Philistine is not able to match God.
Absolutely. So where do we get David's response? Sorry, we're going to have to dig into the text. So 26, thank you. And 26 he says, who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God? In other words, Goliath makes a rather different impression on David from what he makes on the rest of the people. Why? He's got faith, yeah? And because he's not looking, he's not impressed by, I mean, externally, surely he looked very impressive. But what does he see? He sees an uncircumcised person defying the armies of the living God. Then he also gets told about the reward. How many times is the reward mentioned, and what is the reward? Don't look at me, okay? I know some of you are looking at me. If you're looking at the screen, that's fine. And if you're trying to squint at the screen, you can always sit. There's a bit more space on the front row. Find a friend who can lend you a Bible or you know, light up your iPhone or something. Okay?
Three times
there's mentioned a reward. And of course, when there's been talking about the reward, someone gets rather annoyed. Who gets annoyed? His brothers? Plural? Eliab. Okay, tell me about Eliab. What do we know about Eliab? He's the oldest brother. Okay, now Eliab's response is what? He's angry. Okay, so I'm going to read it. Verse 28. Eliab's anger was kindled against David, and he said, why have you come down, and with whom have you left those few sheep in the wilderness? Now, let's start with that second question. With whom have you left those few sheep in the wilderness? What's the answer? What's the answer as to where he's left those sheep? He left them with a keeper. By the way, just as he left the cheese with a keeper, he had also left the sheep with a keeper. Now, let's go back to our question earlier. Did Jesse have anyone else he could send? Yeah, we know he had the keeper he could have sent. So the point is this, that God is making it, superintending this, such that Jesse sends David at exactly this point. Now, it's interesting. Eliab has got a thin line to tread here, because he says, with whom have you left those few sheep in the wilderness? Now, what's the thin line we could say that Eliab has to tread here? Uh-huh. Right, so that's a great thing. That at one level, he wants to downplay the job that David's doing. I mean, looking after the few sheep. And if it's just a few sheep, I mean, why does it matter so much if they get lost? And of course, you know, he's really concerned about those sheep, isn't he? And of course, with who did he leave them? He left them with a keeper. So he really despises his brother. Now, should Eliab despise his brother, given what Eliab knows? What does Eliab know about his brother? That's right. From the previous chapter, when Samuel has gone and anointed David, Eliab, the older brother, knows it. So therefore, Eliab is despising whom? He's despising the Lord's anointed, we could say. But what did he say? Why have you come down? And with whom have you left those few sheep in the wilderness? I know your presumption and the evil of your heart, for you've come down to see the battle. Okay, Eliab has a view about David's heart. My question is this: what do we know about Eliab's heart and how? Speak up. He's jealous. Okay, how do we know that? Apart from this passage, is there any other text that tells us about Eliab's heart? Could someone read for us 1 Samuel chapter 16? This is the previous chapter, verses 6 through to 7. I'd need a microphone for this. Just put your hand up and the mic is going to come. 1 Samuel 16, verses 6 through to 7. This is the anointing scene, and we're going to learn about Eliab's heart. Someone there at the back? Microphone's just over there. Grab the chance while it's coming past. Yeah. Madam here. Oh, sir. Okay, thank you.
When they entered, he looked at Eliab and thought, "Surely the Lord's anointed is before him." But the Lord said to Samuel, "Do not look at his appearance or at the height of his stature, because I have rejected him. For God sees not as man sees. For man looks at the outward appearance, but God looks at the heart."
Okay, so we have a mention of Eliab's heart there. What is God's view of Eliab's heart? Well, it doesn't tell us too much, but simply that God has looked at Eliab's heart and said he is not going to be king. And yet here we see Eliab saying to the Lord's anointed, whose heart the Lord has looked on and said, he's the man I'm going to choose. And Eliab says, "I know the evil of your heart." Now let's have a time of sort of applying this. I think we sometimes see people, and maybe they seem to be shooting past us. They seem to be getting very successful very early, getting lots of recognition and so on. What do we tend to think about their hearts? We tend to attribute to them sometimes all sorts of evil things and motives. But what's that really coming from? It's actually coming from our own hearts. It's more a reflection of what we are thinking. And then what does he say? "I know the evil of your heart. You've come down to see the battle." Now that's interesting. What's Eliab been doing the last 40 days militarily? Yeah, I mean, he seems to have been a bit of an onlooker, doesn't he? I mean, so the irony of it is everything that he charges David of is, of course, exactly what he's not doing. So in one level, we can see, I mean, how ironic this is. Then we have, David said, "Well, wasn't it just a word?" Now, of course, after he's been talking about the reward several times, it's been mentioned three times in the passage, soon the king hears. But let's just find out, what is the reward again? Marries the daughter of the king. No taxes in the land for whom? The family. That's quite good, isn't it? Yeah. So, pretty important thing to have. And one more thing. Great wealth. Okay, thank you. So, David goes before the king Saul. Who's going to speak first? David or Saul? Yeah, I might have to read the passage for this. Who do you expect to speak first? Saul. Who speaks first? And what does he say? What's his opening line? Anyone? "Let no one's heart fail." Okay, now, the interesting thing is here. He is telling the king and everyone else not to be afraid already. Now, often we think, let's say there's a spider. Anyone afraid of spiders here? No. Okay. Well, in England, there are some people who are afraid of spiders. And at least it goes like this, that if you're afraid of a spider and there's a spider in the house, you get someone to remove the spider, then you don't need to be afraid anymore, right? Simple as that. You take away the source of fear, then you're not afraid anymore. And yet, David is not saying,
The source of fear is already taken away. He's saying the source of fear is not yet taken away. I am going to take it away, and already you shouldn't fear. Do you see what I mean? In other words, in our lives, there will sometimes be things that we are afraid of. And the thing is that if we are fearing God, we shouldn't be afraid of those things. We shouldn't need the problem to be resolved before we give up on our fear. So Saul says to him, well, look, you can't fight the Philistine. It's simply not going to happen. Why is Saul saying that? How's Saul judging David? What's he using to judge David? His youth. And what's he do to assess his youth? He looks at him. He's using his eyes. That's right. So he's looking on the outward appearance. Okay? Has we seen anyone else yet looking at the outward appearance in this passage? Eliab has been looking on the outward appearance. Who else has been looking on the outward appearance? The Israelites when they saw the Philistine. Anyone else looking on the outward appearance? Goliath is going to look on the outward appearance. Yeah, and one more person? Jesse, thank you. Jesse looks on the outward appearance because he gives the nice stuff to the commander of 1,000. Everyone's looking on the outward appearance, which is actually what happens in life so much. People look and they rank and they see how important people are. And in that context, we see that David is not looking on the outward appearance. He looks at the Philistine and he sees someone who's uncircumcised, unworthy, and defying God. Now, at this point, David tells the story of what he did with the lion and the bear. Can anyone, and we'll need a microphone for this, describe the technique that David has for dealing with lions and bears? Can we have some microphones out and some hands, and we're going to have some descriptions of his technique. Anyone? Grab him by the beard. Now, a beard on a lion, we might well call a mane. That's right. So what do you have to do before you grab the beard or mane? Run after him. Okay. Now, has anyone here ever chased after a lion or a bear? I mean, you might possibly do it in a crowd, but single-handedly, I did once. I've been saying for a long time, I've never heard of anyone running after a lion or bear, not even a Tarzan film. Someone came up to me after one of my talks and said, actually, I did chase after a bear. But there we are. You know, there are all sorts around. But it's a pretty unusual thing, isn't it? Chasing after a bear. Okay, so he chases after the lion, chases after the bear. He grabs hold of its bear, the bear, or the lion by its hair. And what's he do next? He struck him. Okay, maybe uses a stick. Strikes him. What's the bear or the lion do next? Before that. He drops the lamb. Exactly. Now, what does that free up when he drops the lamb? He frees up his mouth, doesn't it? That's right. And then, what would he do? Okay, well, that's not actually what happened, thankfully. He didn't quite bite David's head off. What happened next? David killed it. How? How in the most profound sense? He struck him, okay, and in a deeper sense of causality? Yeah, he doesn't talk about that. But when David reflects on this at the end of describing this to Saul, what does he say happened? The Lord delivered him from the hand of the bear. Now, the word hand and paw in Hebrew are the same. So, you know, bears have paws or hands and humans have paws or hands. So whether he delivered him from the paw of the bear and is going to deliver him from the paw of the Philistine, it doesn't matter which way around. It's the same thing. The point is, God did it. Now, of course, there may have been human technique involved, but in none of this does David think it was his technique. Now, let's just think about David as a shepherd. Was this a wise way of shepherding? I mean, let's look at a strategic view. You've got 100 sheep, and one of them gets taken off by a wild animal. What should a strategic shepherd do? Protect the rest. Exactly. I mean, it's not very strategic if shepherd gets killed, is it? I mean, if shepherd gets killed, what's going to happen to the rest? So really, a good strategic shepherd should think, look, That's gone off. I mean, I can try and scare the lion off before it comes. I can shout at it. I can wave my stick. But chasing after it in order to deliver the what? What's in its mouth? So it's a lamb, a little one. I mean, why would the smallest of these things, why on earth would you do that? Isn't that completely crazy? I mean, wasn't David completely crazy? No. No, I don't think he was crazy. What we see is a huge diligence. The diligence that means he leaves the sheep with a keeper, that he leaves the cheese with a keeper. He looks after those things. He's really faithful in the small things. In fact, what's he prepared to do? What sort of shepherd is he? He's a responsible shepherd. Do we have anything about responsible shepherds in the New Testament? Jesus, what's the good shepherd do? Lay down his life for the sheep. Now, okay, David didn't do that. But he was prepared to. He was prepared to risk everything for the sake of one lamb. Now, when the Bible gives us this image of shepherding, what shepherding is, it's a really, really striking image. Because a shepherd tends the flock and thinks about the flock first of all. And the image it gives in the Bible is sometimes of what seems to me a reckless shepherd. I mean, Luke chapter 15. What does the shepherd do when one goes missing? Leaves the 99. Now, to me, that's a bit strange, because how does it say in Luke? It says, which shepherd doesn't leave the 99? And I would sort of think, which shepherd does? You know, it seems to be just the wrong way around, as so many of Jesus' parables do seem to be completely the wrong way around. So what we're finding here is something really profound about how before David is given the challenge to fight the Philistine, he's given the challenge of being faithful. Now, how many people were watching? Was this caught on film? No. I mean, there's no YouTube video. I mean, it'd be a great YouTube video, wouldn't it? David chasing after the lion. I mean, wouldn't you just love to put that up on Facebook about yourself? You know, what you've just done. And here we have no one watching. Heroism seen by no one. Heroism for the sake of a little lamb. Now, isn't that an amazing picture of a Christian calling? I mean, the sort of battles against sin that we may have to fight with no one seeing it. No one to, you know, appreciate and cheer and say, well done. But that's actually the thing that God calls us to. Now, David tries on Saul's armor. What's the significance of this? Can anyone tell me the significance of the fact that he's trying on Saul's armor? I think can think of several forms of significance. But the fact that he's trying it on in the first place shows what about what David knows. He doesn't know anything about the armor. And does he know how he's going to defeat the Philistine? He knows he's going to do it by God, but does he know what method, technically, he's going to use? No. The very fact that he's trying on the armor, I mean, he does reject it because it's not something he had experience with, not because it was massively too big, although it probably was, but the point is, the very fact that he's trying this means that he doesn't actually know exactly how he's going to overcome the Philistine. What weapons does he then choose? Five stones and a sling and a staff. Exactly. That's very important. What does a staff show us? He's a shepherd. Okay. Does he get to use the staff? No. Did he know in advance he wasn't going to get to use the staff? No. So in other words, he goes out trusting in God to be with him, but he doesn't know exactly the details. The fact that he had five stones rather than just one means, again, he doesn't know exactly the details. Right? But he's going to be faithful. Now, what happens when he approaches the Philistine? What does the Philistine see? Verse 43. Am I a dog that you come to me with sticks? Now, what's funny about that? Sorry? He had one stick. Okay, yeah. Okay, so maybe he's like cross-eyed or something. Okay, what's fun? Sorry? Okay, he wasn't Jewish. Am I a dog? Yeah, that's right. So the dog is an unclean animal. Sorry? Goliath feels insulted. That's right. Goliath. What would you want to whisper to Goliath if he was like on stage? It's not the stick you should be worried about. Am I a dog you come against with sticks? Goliath, have you seen the other hand? You see, that, I mean, this is ridiculous. That Goliath's eyes see one thing, and the reality is something else. Again and again, these people are just seeing the wrong thing. Am I a dog that you come against me with sticks? Okay, Goliath's threat to David is that he is going to feed his body to the birds of the air and to the beasts of the field. What's David's threat to Goliath? The same? Sort of. Sorry? In the name of the Lord of hosts. What's his threat to Goliath? So Goliath says he's going to feed David. How many dogs and birds is David going to feed? Not that many. Okay, what's David's threat to the Goliath? You got the text in front of you. He'll cut off his head. Yeah, okay, what else? Feed him. Sorry? The bodies of all of the Philistines. Exactly. So whereas Goliath is offering a small meal to the birds and the dogs, what is David saying? He's saying, no, all of the Philistine army is going to be fed to the birds and dogs. And of course, that's what happens because their bodies are going to fall. And that's exactly what is going to happen. So it's really quite incredible that David is not afraid of the Philistine. Now then, he rushes forward. One strike, of course, of that spear and David would be dead. He reaches into his pouch, he slings the stone, and it finds the one part of the Philistine's anatomy that isn't covered, the forehead. What happens to the Philistine next? He falls. Which way? Down, yeah. Fall down. Which way? Face down. Thank you. He did not fall backwards, as I've seen in some Bible story, illustrated Bible story books. He fell forwards. Who? Tell me another Philistine thing that's fallen forwards.
Dagon,
thank you. Tell me, what is Dagon? What is Dagon? Dagon's the idol in the temple, okay? And he fell forward. Now, the point is this, that here we have David. He's got no sword. He takes the Philistine sword. He cuts off his head. And it all happens exactly as David had said it would happen. My question is this. How did David know? How did David know that he could do that? Well, you might say he had a special revelation. But if we just discount that as a possibility for a moment, which is that is a real possibility, how else did David know that he was going to defeat the Philistine? He had faith. Faith in what? God. Yeah, but how did he know he was going to defeat the Philistine? His experience of what? His training. Yeah, we're hearing his experience, his training. I'm still missing what I think is the right answer. It may be the wrong answer, but I think it's the right answer. He was God's anointed. Thank you. And what does that mean? He has been anointed to be the future king. Is he the future king at the moment? Is he the king now? No. He knows that he is indestructible until he becomes king because God said he's going to be king. In other words, God has given him specific revelation, specific knowledge of what will happen, and that means he has to know that he can't be killed until that point. So what we see is then he destroys the Philistine, and that all works out right. Then those last five verses, they're a bit puzzling, aren't they? I mean, why, after all this nice story, do you have this thing about, you know, he's going out to battle and Saul doesn't know who he is? What's going on there? There are four clues. Does it say that Saul doesn't know David's name? What does the passage say? We're looking at the last. His father. Why would Saul be bothered who his father was? Ah, that's the family that's going to be made free from taxes. That's the family into which, of course, there's going to be a marriage alliance. So Saul saw David go out and he said, Abner, whose son is this youth? As your soul lives, I don't know. The king says, inquire whose son the boy is. And then, of course, he comes in And whose son are you, young man? David says, I'm the son of your servant, Jesse the Bethlehemite. It's not a story about whether he knew David or not. David had been, some people say this is a contradiction. He'd been playing the harp. I mean, how can he not know who he is, right? The point is, it's all about who his father is. Saul had sent a message to Jesse before, but I don't expect a king to remember all of his correspondence. Okay, that's pretty much like a highlight in David's life. What's the low light in David's life? David and Bathsheba. Okay, I want you to think about David and Bathsheba and what's similar or different from this passage. And a little clue would be to think about what happens straight after David and Bathsheba. Anyone had a thought? A clue might be the word sheep. Sorry, David? Nathan confronted David. Are we able to have 2 Samuel 12 up on the text? Is that possible? 2 Samuel 12, 1 to 9. Could someone read us 2 Samuel 12, 1 to 9? I've got a microphone to you. Just stick up a hand. We've got someone here. Okay. 2 Samuel 12, 1 to 9. Let's listen to this and listen out for the sheep.
Then the Lord said to Nathan, sent Nathan to David, and he came to him and said, there were two men in one city, the one rich and the other poor. The rich man had a great many flocks and herds, but the poor man had nothing except one little ewe lamb, which he bought and nourished. And it grew together with him and his children. It would eat of his bread and drink of his cup and lie in his bosom, and was like a daughter to him. Now a traveler came to the rich man, and he was unwilling to take from his own flock or his own herd to prepare for the wayfarer who had come to him. Rather, he took the poor man's ewe lamb and prepared it for the man who had come to him. Then David's anger burned greatly against the man and said to Nathan, as the Lord lives, surely the man who has done this deserves to die. He must make restitution for the lamb fourfold, because he did this thing and had no compassion. Nathan then said to David, you are the man. Thus says the Lord God of Israel, it is I who anointed you king over Israel, and it is I who delivered you from the hand of Saul. I also gave you your master's house and your master's wives into your care, and I gave you the house of Israel and Judah. And if it had been too little, I would have added to you many more things like these. Why have you despised the word of the Lord by doing evil in his sight? You have struck down Uriah the Hittite with a sword, have taken his wife to be your wife, and have killed him with the sword of the sons of Ammon.
Thank you. What's changed in David? He sinned. His heart. I think that's right. And in particular, we can see it with his heart in relation to lambs. I mean, what's gone on is he began as a shepherd. What is he at this stage? He's a king, yeah. But what's he being in relation to this story that Nathan tells? What role does he play? Murderer. He's more like a murderer, and he's not caring for sheep at all, is he? He's actually feeding off them. He's almost like a wolf, isn't he? He's a predator on sheep. Do you see? He's gone all that way from being someone who cares for sheep, that would give everything for the sheep, to being a predator. And that, in one sense, is a story of David's life up to that point. Now, the wonderful thing is, of course, the Lord restores him. There are troubles after that, but he really does come back to God. But we see a lot of warning. If you look at the passages in between, I think you can actually see it's not just a sudden thing that happens to David with David and Bathsheba. It's a gradual thing where he has shifted from that position of being prepared to give up everything of his comfort to care for the little lamb and at risk everything to actually feeding off the kingdom. Okay, Let's have a time of application. We've just got 5 more minutes or so. Let's have some microphones going round. And I want you to tell us and share with us the things that you think God might be telling us from this passage that will help us in our lives today. So we can look big picture, just or little thoughts that you have. Anyone, just raise a hand. Share with us, bless us, something from this passage. Anyone, this is the conclusion, the summary, bringing things together. Any themes that have come to you? Don't be shy. Focus on God and not self. Okay, just raise a hand, please, for microphone so everyone can hear. Yeah, back there.
Doing God's work with man's ways is not the way to go.
Thank you. We got a couple here.
Judge by the heart, not the externals.
Sorry?
Judge the heart, not the externals.
Judge the heart, not the externals. I mean, really don't look on the externals, I think, is there, yeah.
Also, David had gotten comfortable in his position of being king, and he had not gone out to the battle.
Yeah.
And he wasn't fighting anymore.
It's quite a move from sort of running after a lion that's taken off a lamb to not even going out for battle, isn't it? Yeah, okay.
I was going to say the same thing.
Yeah, thank you. Others?
It is the same like we are. As we come to the Lord, and the first time we are fervent, listen to the Lord's word. But the worldly things make us go away from our focus, away from the Lord. Now that our heart is not as fervent to the Lord because of the society influences.
Thank you. Thank you. You got someone over here?
After a victory comes a test.
Thank you.
David lost his humility and became prideful.
Thank you. Yeah. Okay. Few more chances to share?
Not a hair on your head will be touched unless the Lord ordains it.
Thank you. That's a really key thing. That just if the Lord asks us to do something risky, you know, He's going to be with us. Of course, there will be times that you do have to give up your life. The Good Shepherd actually gave up his life for the sheep. Anyone else? Got time for a few more? Steve there.
Similar to the last one, trust God's promises and act accordingly.
Thank you. God can use anyone. I mean, in one sense, you know, David was a nobody, and often he was most effective when he was a nobody, the little brother that they just leave behind, you know, looking after the sheep. I mean, after all, when he came back home telling them stories about the lion he'd just fought, they thought, yeah, right. Yeah. Anyone else? Well, I think we've got someone just at the back there.
Don't promote yourself to something that the Lord has not called you.
Thank you. And I think that's an application particularly from Eliab. And then we got, just let's get the microphone here.
David admitted he had sinned. Today in politics, a good example. None of them have sinned.
Thank you very much. I think we'll end there, so we've got one more. Okay, great.
We should be cautious about judging others who are doing them.
Yeah, thank you. That's really helpful. I just want to introduce at the back here, we've got Philip Evans, who's the executive director of the American Friends of Tinder House, and it'd be great if anyone wants to meet him. He's come all the way in from Houston, Texas, where he lives, and he's just here standing at the back. I don't know if there's anything you want to say, but...
Yes, let me just say a couple of things, and if technology works... we're going to see a short video.
Oh, a short video, okay.
How many of you were able to come to the conference that we did Friday night and Saturday morning?
Use my microphone.
Great. They can hear it, I think. It was a great opportunity for you to hear more teaching, and I know you've enjoyed Peter this morning. Peter and Dirk led some great sessions, and one of the things we do in our conferences is have a chance for people to ask their most difficult Bible questions, and so it's a great opportunity. Our purpose in life is equipping the people of God to understand the Bible. Now, we teach and equip people in Cambridge, England, but we do these types of things in the U.S., and it's a great way to reach out to a larger audience. So I want you to look at a quick video and pay close attention, because I want to see if you recognize anybody in this video.
3.5 minutes, and that's it.
In 1944, some people of immense vision founded Tyndale House in Cambridge. But what is Tyndale House? Well, it has a library which aims to have all the books you need for serious study of the Bible.
The libraries here are wonderful.
They have a very good library.
One of the three best libraries for Bible studies in the world.
I think it is the best in the world in terms of a compact library where the needs of high-level Old Testament and New Testament scholarship in particular can be carried out so effectively.
Fine push.
The community has just been absolutely amazing.
Research is not only books, which is a lot of here, but it's people, talking to people.
This is a place where people who are carrying out really significant ministries across the world meet for the first time and make friendships that last for life. It's a working and worshipping community which fosters biblical scholarship at the highest level in service to the church. It's also a very efficient place to work.
I absolutely love Big at Tyndale House, and more than enjoying it, it is making it possible for me to pursue my PhD.
The reason I'm here in Tyndale is that I want to be trained a bit more in biblical languages and for the work of future Bible translation back in Mongolia.
Being able to come here to just focus on my project, I'm actually for the first time in the whole project ahead of the game, which is really good. It's very easy to focus here.
I love it here. It's the fellowship at Tyndale, the books, the university, the city itself is wonderful.
This is a wonderful place because I study all day until the closing time, and then I can go home and sleep.
So it just makes for a much more efficient work experience.
We also meet to worship. Tyndale House is a place where church leaders are equipped, but also a place where people who teach the church leaders are equipped.
You meet people here at Tyndale that you could never meet in one place anywhere else in the world.
I have friends now, I think, on 5 different continents, just from people I've met here.
While I'm studying here, I've met many people.
I've met people that I'll be in touch with for the rest of my life.
It's been delightful in every way because it promoted my research, made things smooth sailing, a great place to be, and all the people that we've met.
Were it not for Tyndale House, the PhD would have stopped right then and there.
So it would be very hard to imagine doing PhD without Tyndale House.
Tyndale House is a small organisation with a quite disproportionate impact, and it's one that you can be involved in as a prayer supporter, financial supporter, volunteer or advocate. There's so much more to be done to provide Bible experts for the church, and it's a team effort.
Tyndale House, in my view, is a marvel. I value it, I rejoice in it, I talk about it, I support it, I pray for it.
Just because we see the immense value it has for strengthening the church and the church's understanding of the Bible throughout the world.
We have no better advocate for Tyndale House than Wayne Grudem, and you get to experience him frequently. So Wayne has spent several years of his life at Tyndale House, and you can see the kind of product that comes out of a Bible study at a deep level, and we certainly appreciate Wayne and him supporting us and his support having us here today. At the back of the room, I know we're pressed a little bit of time to get to the service if you're going to later service, but I've got some material. Please look at it, some brochures, some bookmarks, and also some story cards. You saw some people in the video. We are a missions organization that happens to have a biblical research library at its heart. So we have people from all over the world studying at Tyndale House, and then they go back to their countries and minister in those countries, either as teachers, preachers, professors, and tutors. So we have all kinds of stories. We have a few of those at the back, some from Cuba, Eastern Europe, Mongolia, and Africa. So take a look at that. We'd love to have you as prayer supporters, as financial supporters, to look at that information and sign up for our email newsletter so you can find out where we're going to be, what's going on, where people at Tyndale House are ministering these days, and we'd love to have you know a little bit more about it. So thank you, Wayne.
Thank you, Philip Evans, and thank you for coming from Houston to set up this conference. As I was listening to Peter and all of you work through this passage, I was mildly rebuked in my own heart because when I introduced Peter, I told all about outward appearance and not about his heart. Because I was telling about all his academic achievements and his publications and his appointments at different universities and things. Let me tell you, I was aware that there was a vacancy for the leadership of Tyndale House, what, 5-6 years ago, and did pray for quite some time that God would bring the right person there, because I know it's so strategic in the work of the kingdom. And when I heard that Peter Williams had been appointed to lead Tyndale House, my heart rejoiced, because this man has been an elder at Eden Baptist Church. If you went to Cambridge and lived there for a year, that's the church you would go to, because it's the church that's most like Scottsdale Bible Church. In order to be an elder there, your heart has to be faithful to God's word, faithful to the Lord, and you have to be a man of prayer. And Peter is certainly that. And so I'm thankful to the Lord. Pray for him, because it's worldwide a very strategic appointment and a very strategic position, because he's influencing all these PhD students who come through and talk with him, get counsel with him, get guidance and leadership from him. So, and then he's right there with Cambridge University, which is a secular university by and large, roots in the Church of England, but much more liberal than Tyndale House would be. And but to be there and continually interact with that university and everything going on in it, you need to be spiritually strong. So pray for him and support him as God leads you. But I am thankful for him. Thank you, Peter, wherever you are, for your presentation today. We appreciate it very much. See you next week. All right.